Hi, this is Greg Rempe, host of the Barbecue Central Show, and you're listening to the Baseball and BBQ Podcast with your hosts, Jeff the Old Coot Cohen and Leonard Hollywood Aberman.
Baseball and BBQ on Long Island, New York. This is episode number 230 of Baseball and BBQ. I'm Jeff the Oku Cohen, along with Leonard Hollywood Aberman. We welcome you back to our show, Leonard.
How are you, Jeff? Episode 230. You know how I like the fives and the tens. 230.
Yes, you do.
It's a good round number. Who knows? But we've got a good episode here, Jeff.
We do. Who's on it?
Yeah. Well, you know, for baseball lovers, we've got Lou Friedman with his book, Tales from the Clubhouse, Great Baseball Moments Remembered. And Lou has spoken to more baseball players than we've probably seen play. I mean, he's really, his stories are terrific.
He wrote a few books.
Yeah, a few. So I think everyone's going to like that. But Jeff, then, you know, we don't just stop with baseball.
Nah.
It is the baseball and barbecue podcast. So tell us about our barbecue guest.
We have Richard Fergola of Fergalicious BBQ. Fergie.
Oh, it's going to be a great show. Just before we get to that, Jeff, I got to tell you guys something. Bet Online continues to be your number one source for all your baseball wagering needs, including pro and college hoops throughout the year. With up-to-the-minute odds, stats, and trends, you can follow your favorite team's path to the playoffs with in-game live betting, contests, and yes, all the best player props. Experience the world's best wagering platform anytime from your desktop or your mobile devices. So this is what you do. You head to BetOnline today to become part of the team. And remember, use your promo code BLEAVE and you're going to save 50%. It's a welcome bonus on your first deposit. Bet online. It is where the game starts.
And Leonard, how are we starting?
Let's start by getting right to Lou Friedman and his book, Tales from the Clubhouse. Great Baseball Moments Remembered.
Back for a second time on Baseball and BBQ. Lou Friedman is a veteran newspaper sports writer and experienced author of more than 75 books about sports and Alaska subjects. He spent 17 years at the Anchorage Daily News in Alaska and also has worked for the Chicago Tribune and the Philadelphia Inquirer. Lou is the recipient of over 250 journalism awards. Mr. Friedman is a prolific journalist and has a byline in newspapers in every state in America and most Canadian provinces, too. He has great knowledge of baseball history, which is reflected in the book, Tales from the Clubhouse, Great Baseball Moments Remembered. Welcome back to Baseball and BBQ, Lou Friedman. Welcome, Lou.
Thanks for having me. Always fun to be here.
Thank you. Now, Lou, you joined us on episode 94. Now, we are about to, well, we shouldn't say because by when your interview comes out, it'll be more, but we're in our 200s now. Wow. Did you ever think that you'd be back? And do you remember being on with us the first time?
I was telling my wife I wasn't sure if I did more than one. To tell you the truth, I don't remember the timing, but I do remember being on.
We did speak about the your Cy Young book.
Yes, yeah. Which was great.
Yeah. And he's still dead.
Yeah.
He was not available for comment for this
book. No, not at all.
Well, this book is Tales from the Clubhouse, Great Baseball Moments Remembered from Lou Friedman. Lou, I mean, the book is quite enjoyable because it's I love books like this because you can go to them, you can take a few minutes, read a few pages, put it down. You don't even have to mark your place in the book. You come back to it, you pick it up again, and you're learning something new every time.
And, That's why we call them chapters.
Yes. The book on the cover has, you know, greatest players who haven't played the game: Ernie Banks, Dan Musial, Joe Morgan, Willie Mays, Hank Aaron. Just terrific players. But I'm kind of more interested in the lesser known players. And you have some great stories about them. And here's one I never heard of. And he was not very successful, but making it to major leagues is just something else. Chad Bentz,
I wondered if you were going to bring up Chad.
Because
it's funny because, you know, I knew that I would be including all these. I think there's about 35 Hall of Famers and a couple of people who, you know, will get in, mm-hmm. like Albert Pujols.
Right. And
Dusty Baker. They're not coming there. But I actually did have as much fun telling the other stories of those lesser known guys and their lesser known experiences, because I've asked people how many people remember another baseball player like Jim Abbott.
Right.
And nobody has had an answer for me.
Oh, come Jim. Yes, of course. Pitched a no hitter for the Yankees.
Yeah, but nobody, but we don't think of anybody else.
Anybody else. That's what I was saying. They didn't know of anybody else. And in my case, that is my Alaska background speaking, because I first met Chad when he was a high school football player. And then later when he pitched in the Alaska Summer League.
Right.
And he's a great guy. Mm-hmm. And how can you not root for a guy like that?
Sure.
You know, have that opportunity. So, and just a few years, I maintain connections in Alaska very strongly. I got family in Anchorage. I spent 4 months there last summer, mm-hmm. and I just had another Alaska book come out recently, but I am on the board of directors, not the board of the selection committee of the Alaska Sports Hall of Fame. And we had kind of forgotten Chad. And somebody brought him up, and it was like this great groundswell of support, that meeting. And from being not on the, you know, being considered that day when we started the discussion, he was voted in the same day.
Well, great. I mean, he like he said, he had a handicap. He did not have a right hand, just like Jim Abbott. And he pitched into the major leagues. Like I said, he wasn't very successful. He didn't get, I don't think he got a win, but he did make it to the Montreal Expos.
Yes.
And just getting to the major leagues with that handicap is just astronomical odds.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it's not by accident that there's only been two such people, right?
Right.
Yeah, of course. Again, I was just telling Jeff before you came on, one of my favorite players is Mike Schmidt. And it's, you know, Mike and I have something in common, and it's not that we're both great third basemen. but we did both attend Ohio University. And I said to Jeff, you know, it's funny. Is it just me? Because, you know, when you have a car and then you seem to see that car all over the road, I feel like with Mike Schmidt, every time I read about him, they mention Ohio University. And I don't know why.
It's not that like, a lot.
You know, it's not.
Like, I was around the 1980 Phillies. Which, of course, was a great year to be around the Phillies and right. Mike Schmidt. And, it used to come up often enough. That's
interesting.
I mean, a lot of guys, you forget they ever played college baseball or who they played for. But for some reason, you're right. About Schmidt, it does come up more often.
Yeah. So I said, I don't know if it's because I'm just more cognizant of it or it does, but so it definitely does. How did you decide who went in this book and who ended up on the cutting room floor?
A lot of them were no brainers. I felt, you know, obviously the biggest names, the Hall of Famers, there really weren't very many that I felt I had enough material to have a chapter on who were on the cutting room floor. A handful, maybe. I mean, I don't think there's going to be a volume two because I don't think I'm going to live to be 100. So I don't think I'll be able to add to it in the piecemeal fashion. And really, if you look back, the oldest interviews in there were Tony Conigliaro and Bill Veeck from the 50 years ago. Mm-hmm. That kind of stunned me when I finished.
Wow.
You know, and when I said, 50 years, you're old.
I mean, that's what,
even though they, you know, again, it was all gradual and not premeditated. There were different spurts of times, you know, where I covered more baseball in my career. Clearly, I didn't cover the majors very often when I was in Alaska. You know, but I did when I was with the Philadelphia Inquirer. I left out Tug McGraw, didn't I?
No, he's in the book.
No, he's in here, as a matter of fact.
Because that was a last-minute decision because I had used most of what I had on him in the book about the 1980 Phillies. So I think I did go back and forth on that, saying, is this the same thing twice? But I loved Tug, and I really appreciated, you know, the time that we spent together. That's why I hesitated there, because I thought he really was close to not being included for that reason, not because he wasn't worthy, but because I thought maybe I've said everything I've got on Tug. And then I went, what the heck? Maybe if I repeat myself, he's worthwhile anyway.
Well, speaking about Tug, I was going to say this later, but Tug McGraw, I happen to like him better on the 69 Mets, but that's beside the point. You spent time with him, and I'm going to read right from the book. We spent our time in an expansive backyard sitting in a considerable shadow of his 22-foot-long barbecue. 22-foot-long barbecue?
There's a guy you needed to have.
I know.
I know. He said he was still redecorating, and that was like a couple of years into living there. I'm sitting in a room right now, my office, so to speak, where I have a framed Tug McGraw, Dick Perez, a poster of Tug leaping in the air in the exact moment when they won the World Series, the famous picture that he made. And as soon as I saw it on Dick Perez's list of available things, I said I had to have it. You know,
yeah.
So it's about 6 feet from me.
and Lou, I like oddities, and I don't know if the knuckleball's considered an oddity, but you know, I was a big R.A. Dickey fan. Obviously, I was a big Phil Niekro fan. I'm reading the Phil Niekro chapter, and at the end of it, you talk about this sandwich that I guess you never got to try with him. But
no,
tell us what the sandwich was.
I didn't even know he was sick when he was passed away. And I had been in touch with him with some regularity. So, and, you know, and he and I had the same birth date.
Oh, okay.
April 1st, by the way. you know, it's funny. I didn't even really know that much about the sandwich. You know, I knew he was still a guy who was revered in Atlanta. And in fact, the time I spent the longest interview I ever did with him was in the minor league park in, was it Marietta, I think. And I ended up writing so much about the knuckleball. I have a knuckleball book, and it's Phil's hand on the cover, photo of his knuckles. You know, he just, maybe I thought he was going to live forever because he could have pitched forever. You know, like a knuckleball guy. I kept waiting for one of those guys to make it to 50.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. Before we get on another topic, I've got to tell everyone, the sandwich, Phil Niekro's favorite, it was called the Nuxie. It includes smoked pulled pork, caramelized onions, pickles, and coleslaw on skillet cornbread, and it's covered with barbecue sauce. That's a sandwich. Now, Jeff, you can go. But
it sounds filling.
I was just gonna say that also Hoyt Wilhelm and Wilbur Wood are in the book, also knuckleballers.
Hoyt Wilhelm is my next book, baseball book. It's just come out.
Oh.
I didn't expect it this fast.
Uh-huh.
It actually showed up on my doorstep like a week ago or so.
Nice.
I had no idea.
Well, we need it. We got to get him. We got to get you back on.
Is that book number 250 or something?
And I interviewed Wilbur for that book, too, as well. And I've had some wonderful conversations with Wilbur Wood. I just was so sorry the way his career ended with the line drive off the leg. He was a guy who might have pitched till he was 52.
<Right. laughs>
And he had some of the most incredible stats of the 20th century.
Yeah.
376 and two-thirds innings. None of us will live long enough to see that again.
No.
I mean, it's a big deal when somebody pitches 200 innings now.
Exactly.
I haven't gotten over that yet.
Yeah. No. It's going to take a long time for me, too. And, you know, Wilbur Wood, he had, what, 4 or 5 20-game wins seasons in a row? We're never going to see that again either.
Well, and he also had 20 losses once or twice. He had a 24 and 20 year.
Right. Yeah.
Again, that's a throwback in itself.
Sure, sure.
Even for him, even in the 70s and all. I mean, that wasn't something you saw.
Mm-hmm.
But great guy. And I'm when I was a kid, I had him, his rookie card. I was 9 years old. He came out as a, when they had the 1960 set, where, you know, and they were very colorful and flashy. And he was a local guy with the Red Sox.
Mm-hmm.
And then he never made it with the Red Sox.
Right.
I was, you know, he had the luck and the good fortune to turn his career around. But it, 2 or 3 years, the Red Sox would bring him up and he didn't win a game.
Mm-hmm.
I think about 3 years worth of cameos, he didn't win a game. So, and I don't know what he would have ended up with if he didn't have that line drive from Ron LaFleur off his leg.
Exactly.
And
he'd probably still throw the knuckler, and I think he's 80.
Oh, really?
Probably.
You have in here a player that through association, unfortunately, we never got to meet, but we've been, Jeff and I have been to the Negro Leagues Baseball Museum in Kansas City.
Great place.
Yeah. And Bob Kendrick, the president of the museum, had a special relationship with Buck O'Neill. You have a chapter with Buck O'Neill. Could you tell us a little bit about that chapter, about Buck O'Neill? Because I'll never get tired of hearing about this man.
Got to tell you, I was very fortunate to have the opportunity to meet with Buck and to interview him. He, and I think it was a, less than a year before he died. He was in his early 90s, and I think he died at 92 or 93.
Mm-hmm.
And I somehow arranged, I was doing a project of a book that wanted me to, a company who wanted me to write about the history of sort of Black baseball players. And I just thought, how great would it be if I can get Buck O'Neill to talk about this? I managed to arrange to meet with him at the museum in Kansas City is when I went there. And the one thing I always remember is that he had an, for a guy who was what, 91 or 92 at the time, an amazingly firm handshake. As well as having very large hands. I'm not that big a guy, but his hands were very large. You could tell this guy had a lot of power in him still from, you know, his younger days of playing.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I guess you never really can run out of stories on Buck O'Neill until everybody who ever met him has passed away. But a wonderful man, you know, to spend time in. And I feel lucky that I did. Have my couple hours with him, essentially.
Yeah.
And it was in Kansas City at the museum.
Right. And, you know, Bob tells how, you know, that year, Buck O'Neill, they thought he would go into the Hall of Fame. And there was a group of players that did, and he didn't.
17 people, and they didn't take him.
Right. And he was
amazing.
And Buck O'Neill was, though, very proud to go up there and give a speech. And then he passes away, and then he gets in the Hall of Fame. And you have another player in the book who also even said, I don't want to get in after I pass away. And when does he get in after he passes away?
I'm assuming you mean Ron Santo?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I believe that was
him. And I knew Ron from my Chicago days, too.
Mm-hmm.
He was another gentlemanly, great guy to be around. And you never... You know, when you went to the ballpark and he was out there early, it was just, even if you just talked to him with a hello, he was always in a good mood, glad to be at the ballpark, and had a funny story to tell most of the time. You know, and yeah, I remember being pretty angry the year that they, you know, had that committee and did not take Buck O'Neill.
Right.
Yeah.
Secondarily, Minnie Minoso.
Right.
Who eventually also got in after he died.
Yes. Yeah, it might have been him that said it. in the book. Might have been him, but yeah, again, I understand when a player dies prematurely, you know, not that Tug McGraw went in the Hall of Fame, but, you know, died in his 50s. Nobody expected it, brain tumor. But when you have a player who, you know, he's in his 90s, when you, I mean, I know there's, they can't like put someone in just because they're afraid he's going to die. But I just hate the fact that these players can't enjoy it while they're alive.
Well, I was just offended that they could have a committee and review all those years and not have him be on the list.
Yeah. Yeah. Doesn't make sense.
That's what it was for me.
It doesn't make
sense. You know, and at that point, and then the Hall of Fame itself, in response, put up that Buck O'Neill statue, you know, created an achievement award in his name. So you know where they were coming from on the vote.
Right.
And then once that happened, you really never thought he was going to be in the Hall of Fame, you know, and then he gets in.
And I know exactly where that statue is. You're going through the admission, you make a right, and it's going to be in the
right
corner there. Yeah,
that's
exactly
right. Yep.
You know, like I said, I was more interested, not, I mean, interested in the whole thing, but, you know, some of the less known players, one of them, George Altman, was only one of three players who played in the Negro Leagues, the Major Leagues, and Japan. I thought that was
a great trivia item.
Yeah.
Isn't it?
Yes,
Larry
it is.
Doby and Don Newcomb are the other two.
And I didn't know they went to Japan.
Yeah, I spent a fair amount of time with George. He's getting up there now.
Mm-hmm.
He must be in his late 80s, but nice man. He took up horseshoes.
Did he?
After baseball and became pretty good at it for a while. He lives in the suburbs of St. Louis.
Yeah.
Unless he's moved, and I don't know. But but he had an interesting career, you could say. He also went to college and played.
Yeah.
At Tennessee State.
He also played for the Cubs, the Cardinals, and one season with our New York Mets.
Yeah, he's not remembered for that one.
No, I didn't remember him either.
He had a good time and a good stay in Japan.
Mm-hmm.
He really did, you know. Mm-hmm. But again, it shows you, well, they all seem to be coming in this direction, the players nowadays, from Japan to the U.S. Although I bet you there's always going to be some guys who we forgot about who are on some roster in Japan or are playing.
Mm-hmm.
Either we don't hear about it or, you know, they're there, though.
The book is called Tales from the Clubhouse, Great Baseball Moments Remembered. We are speaking to journalist and author Lou Friedman. Lou, one of the things that I love about this book, other baseball books, you know, don't always succeed in doing this, is that I learned something new about the players, you know, and that's, some of these players are very well known. You know, you've got Hank Aaron in here, Willie Mays, Stan Musial, and you have things that I was unaware of. So I appreciate that because it makes you want to read. You know, you could look at this and say, oh, well, I know about a lot of these players, but you don't. That's the thing. There's always those extra tidbits, and I like that.
Well, it depends how much they give of themselves over the years, too. But I met some of them in non-traditional ways. If you look at, I interviewed Ted Williams in a field standing outside of spring training as a spontaneous meeting. Willie Mays, I was the boxing writer for the Philadelphia Inquirer when he was a greeter at the casino in Atlantic City, showing up for the fights.
And kicked out of baseball.
Had him out of baseball. And I used to see him so often, we just would say hello till I managed to trap him into sitting down and talking for a chat. And then darned if the first summer I moved to Anchorage, Alaska, who shows up but Willie Mays to make a public appearance, which is the last time I saw him, 40 years ago. But for that while, I regret that I never met Mickey Mantle. You know, fortunate that I met these other guys, Ted Williams, Stan Musial, Willie Mays, but I never did beat Mickey Mantle.
You mentioned your time in Anchorage, Alaska, and a lot of this book does, you know, happen in Alaska. You're talking to these players, and one of them was Jim Palmer. If you can go into that story, that'd be great.
Yeah, Jim Palmer, who would think he would show up in Anchorage, Alaska, making a public appearance at a store selling the underwear? And I went as a sports columnist to see him and watch the scene. And some of the women were pretty funny. They were fawning all over him like he was a GQ model, you know, and that's what added to the story. I mean, they were, yeah, they were kind of funny people. I didn't know any of them. But, you know, when I had the whole group of women who left their office at lunchtime, mm-hmm, to go see Jim Palmer because they, you know, because he was selling his underwear, because I guess they had seen one of those full page ads when he was in his briefs.
Yes.
You know, that was an unlikely encounter, you know. And yeah, I did also run into him once in an elevator at a Mariners game, I think, mm-hmm, later. But, you know, that was just a hello.
Right.
And all that. But the other one was a story that was, again, how do you ever think you're going to do that? You never know who's going to show up there. I was just working on this fishing book I'm doing today. You know who used to own a house in Kenai, Alaska, on the Kenai River? It was Carl Malone.
Oh, really?
He used to fish like crazy. Mm-hmm. And in 1996, I was at the Olympics, and I was trying to get near him to talk to him about his passion for fishing in Alaska. And it was like, this is the second dream team. So, you know, they were like rock stars. And uh-huh, the press conference for the pre-Olympic thing was like in an auditorium, hundreds, right, of people. I get the microphone finally and try to cram three questions into one. And when I said to him, so Carl, so what, blah, 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 blah. How is it that you have a house and love fishing on the Kenai River? And the first thing he says to me was, thanks for giving away my secret place. Which was not a secret. Everybody in Alaska knew he had a house there. So, and then actually I caught him at practice after that to talk more about it. But I was just revisiting that today. But it's like, Paul Malone, he did sell the house. He's not there anymore. Unless he bought another one, I don't know.
Now his secret is safe.
Everybody on the river who fishes there, and the guys, they would go down the river and say, oh, there's Carl Malone's house. So it wasn't much of a secret.
So in Alaska, now I know, I'm going to get to my point here. So you had Jim Palmer, who pitched in the 1969 World Series. You saw him in Alaska. I know Tom Seaver pitched in the Alaska College League when he was, before he became pro.
Right.
Speaking of that, his teammate you have in the book, Jerry Kuzman, who is, if not an ace, he would have been an ace on other teams, but not on the Mets because the Mets had Tom Seaver. But Jerry Kuzman was another great interview that you had with him.
Another odd one.
Yeah.
I mean, being in Auburn, New York, 20 miles from Syracuse, mm-hmm, when I wasn't even a sports writer for the Syracuse paper at the time, I said I wanted to go. You know, and he was signing autographs and everything. Mm-hmm. And I think I put in the book, that was the first time anyone ever asked me for my autograph.
Right, right.
Some kid who was there who thought I was important. Uh-huh. And I figured, there's nothing I could say to dissuade him to say, you don't want my autograph.
Right.
Because he would have been offended.
Right.
You know, so yeah, but you know, guys came there, and Ferguson Jenkins, who I did a book with eventually, I actually first met him in Fairbanks, Alaska, at the Midnight Sun Game, the famous Midnight Sun, yeah, Game. Bill Lee came back to pitch a game there in his 50s, mm-hmm, and I happened to be there. I mean, it wasn't premeditated at all. So, of course, you have all these guys who did pass through the Alaska League over decades and make a success of themselves. So that's part of it. One time, I mean, Eddie Gallardo, the relief pitcher from the Twins and all, I think I once approached him to do an interview in a locker room and told him I was with the Anchorage Daily News. And he said, I always have time for someone from Anchorage, because he had such a good time and because he had such a good experience with his summer parents that he still wrote to. So that, yeah, can give you an idea, too, of why that works. Yeah. And my friend Bob Ely, who was the sports editor of the Fairbanks paper for many years, had that kind of rapport with Dave Winfield.
Ah.
I mean, I got Dave Winfield in there, but Bob told me just last summer, Winfield has always returned his calls and always been cooperative with him and just fondly remembers his time in Alaska.
So, you know, Lou, as we're talking, I thought, oh, you know, we're talking about putting expansion teams in other places. talking about Alaska. Let me look up. What's the population of Alaska? Yeah, no. 2021, the population was 732,000. So
I think it's in the high sixes at the moment. And Anchorage is like 300. No hope.
Not getting a major league team.
The closest they came, you remember the, now what the G League is. There used to be the Eastern Basketball League and the Continental Basketball League. Well, when it was Continental, they had a team, the Anchorage Northern Knights. Mm-hmm. And what killed them was their expenses, travel expenses.
Right.
So that'll show you it ain't happening.
Right.
Well, you know, baseball, you know, wants a someday, maybe, you know, Europe, right? Because they're trying to bring in, you know, they're having the games in London this year. And so, and that, again, that'll also be travel expenses will definitely, if that ever happens, would
logistics. It will be some kind of reach.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely.
How they pull that one off. It'd almost have to be like California was with two teams when they both went to the coast, you know, mm-hmm. or something. But even that's not enough. You know?
And Hawaii doesn't have a team, obviously, but the population is higher. And I'll bet a lot of players would want to live there.
They still have a AAA team?
I think so.
The Islanders still
the Hawaiian
there?
Islanders, yes.
Yeah. They've had that for a long time.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
And all that.
Let's talk about Cincinnati Reds' Jim Maloney, who pitched a no-hitter in 1965, only to have it taken away from him.
Well, actually, Jim Maloney pitched, three no-hitters, right?
Uh-huh. Yeah.
He still gets credit for two. And I talked to him maybe 2 years ago about that. I don't even know what hit me with me deciding I should do a column because I'm in Reds territory.
Uh-huh.
And he still seems a little bitter about it. I don't blame him. I remember that was another thing when they changed the rules and rewrote history, kind of irked me.
Yeah.
But no one worse than Harvey Haddix, right?
Right. Yeah.
The game we called the longest, best, perfect game ever. And they took it away.
Took it away.
Yeah, I mean, the 12-inning game. And, you know, I did a book on Harvey Haddix in that game and the Pirates. And Hank Aaron was on base and made a mistake. And he wouldn't do an interview with me about that.
No.
He was still working for the Braves in their office. And I called the officer. He wouldn't talk to me about it. I mean, he was called out for, like, running out of the base paths or something when it could have been. It was on the winning play. Where it should have been like a two-run homer maybe, and he missed second base or he didn't cross the plate or something like that. But he wouldn't talk to me about it, about that game. So I always remembered that part.
You know, we get asked all the time, you know, what's your favorite? Who's your favorite guest? Who we always say Lou Friedman, of course.
But
we get asked, you know, there's definitely ones that are near and dear to your heart. But I'm going to ask you, are there a couple in here that are just your favorites, your favorite player, your favorite story that you want to, if you were telling someone about the book that you'd say, oh, you got to see this, you got to read that?
I can tell you the player I had the most fun with and the best time with. But that was because I was doing a book with him. So I was with him for an extended period. And that's Juan Marichal. Because I never thought I'd get to the Dominican Republic. And beyond that, I mean, we did day after day of hanging out in his man cave, which was, you know, with baseball memorabilia surrounding us. We went out to dinner late one night in a restaurant. And of course, the only people there instantly recognized him. We went to a Winter League baseball game. You know, he would cause us, we were in regular seats. It was me and him and his son. And that caused a sensation in the crowd. They actually had to put security around us so that he could watch the game without having so many autograph seekers. So it was, you know, it was illuminating in that way, you know, that he was that kind of a figure, you know, which I wasn't shocked to see, but this is a case of seeing it yourself. And in fact, in the middle of the game, ESPN Desporte asked him if he'd come on for an inning or two. So they sent somebody down and gave him headphones in the seat. They didn't even have him go up to the press box. So the whole thing, I mean, I land at the airport there. First thing, I get in a cab to get to my hotel. And the first thing we do is turn onto Sammy Sosa Boulevard. And it's like the whole place was baseball, you know?
Yeah.
And the whole scene. And that's when I saw Albert Pujols at the front desk of my hotel, checking out the first day, which led to my discussion with him that's in the book in the locker room months later. Not that he would remember me from the hotel, but, you know, just his demeanor is so memorable. When I told him, I said that I saw you, you know, last summer, blah, 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 in the lobby. But he was mobbed in the lobby by the workers, the bellmen and all that. You couldn't really get his attention. But then I had to wait after that game. It was a very routine game for him. Didn't want to do a lot of media. But then I said that to him, and he changes completely and says, "You've been to my country. What did you think of it? How did you like it?" It just transformed him and the conversation. So that was kind of marvelous in its own way. And it was an offshoot of the visit to see Juan. But so I do tell people that was the most fun I had. I remember we went to a restaurant called Davy Crockett, which who knew there was one?
Right.
American Steakhouse. But it was after the game, so it wasn't crowded. There was one table occupied by 8 guys. And then, of course, the second we moved in to our table, they knew him. He had to go over and talk to those guys and all that.
Sure.
But it was like that on the street, you know, walking from where we parked the car, too. That happened, you know, when we were walking to the game, people would stop him. And, you know, so it was kind of interesting to see with your own eyes, not just saying he's a hero in the country. But here it is. Happening, that kind of thing.
We're talking to Lou Friedman, the author of Tales from the Clubhouse. You know, you're talking about Albert Pujols. I was so happy to see him get to 700, a milestone that was incredible.
Agree completely.
Yeah, that was, and the way he did it, that was amazing.
Did you give up in July? Did you think he wasn't going to make it? I certainly had serious doubts. Until he heated up there, I didn't think he was going to make it.
It's amazing. It's like he gave the last burst, and just gave everything. And as he did his whole career, and that just the fact he got to it, it's pretty special.
I agree. I mean, I would have hated to see him end up like in 698 or something like that. But again, I seriously had doubts whether he was going to get there until he went on that, as you say, a burst.
Yeah, exactly right. Well, we appreciate your time. I have just one more for you. Like Glenn said, the book is called Tales from the Clubhouse. You have over 50 players you profiled in here, 34 are Hall of Famers. One that I want to talk to you about is a player from where you were born or grew up in Boston, and that's Tony Colagniaro, because his story is he had it all in front of him, and it was such a tragic ending for him, and he had it all. I mean, he had the looks, he had the power, he had Boston in back of him, and you know, I guess he was beamed, and that was it.
Well, it wasn't even that simple, but I mean, this is a guy who might have had certainly one of the most tragic careers and lives. You know, led the American League in home runs. Was he 20 or 21?
Right.
And he was a superstar all over him, you know. 1967, he gets beamed in August, I think, of that year. And the pictures that were taken of him in his hospital bed are pretty horrendous. Of, you know, the swelling, the black and blue, and his head and his face. And misses the rest of the season in the Red Sox wonderful year, the impossible dream year.
Yeah.
And he comes back. It covers, and his vision goes bad again, and it went back and forth for a couple of years, and then people are horrified when he's played better. They've got him, and they trade him to the Angels,
right?
Which is like wrong, you know. It's like one of those things the fan base truly hates.
Yeah,
you know. And then but he can't stick with them anymore either, because his vision is in and out. It was a long process, a good few years. And finally, I don't even know. I mean, I was a year out of college, maybe. And I don't even know how I heard that he was working out or that he was going to make one last comeback try. So I believe it was the month of February, right about this time of year, where I went to Fenway Park to meet him. It was snow on the ground at Fenway Park. He was in the back, he was actually in the trainer's room when I talked to him. And when he was saying, this is it, I'm going to give it one last shot. And he made it. Coming out of spring training, he made the team. And then his eye went bad one more time, and he finally retired.
Yeah.
And then he really, he didn't even know what he was going to do with his life. Mm-hmm. He ended up as a sportscaster and was very successful. I think Providence first, then the West Coast. And when the next tragedy befell him, it was when he had actually had flown from the West Coast to interview for a sportscasting job in Boston to come home, and had his terrible heart attack while his brother was driving him to the airport.
Right.
And then much of the rest of his life was being in a coma.
Yeah.
And going on like that for years, too.
Yeah.
I mean, one thing after another. And he wasn't that old, even after it finally ended.
He passed away at 45, such a young man.
Yeah, everybody in Boston, I think, if you talk to an old Red Sox fan, right away they'll say Tony C.
Yeah, exactly right. Lou, this book is fantastic. So many more stories. We love talking about everyone, but then, you know, people won't buy the book. So we want you to go out, buy the book, Tales from the Clubhouse, Great Baseball Moments Remembered by journalist and author Lou Friedman. Lou, this has been a pleasure. Good luck with the book. We really enjoyed it. Your next book, Hoyt Wilhelm, please come back on.
Well, let me know, because I've got it now.
Okay, thanks.
I barely opened it, but I've got it.
All right.
I hope I get some barbecue out of this one of these days. I told you, I am a barbecue-deprived guy.
Yeah, I know. We have to, we'll have to get a pit master to open a restaurant in Columbus, Indiana.
Well, we could use it.
Yeah.
Thanks, guys, for having me. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Lou. You've been great.
Thank you. Take care, guys.
Hi, this is Gary Mack of the Mets Musings podcast, and if you like barbecue and you like baseball, then you have to listen to Baseball and BBQ with Jeff and Len. They always have the best guests from the world of baseball and the world of barbecue, all in one little package. So check it out, Baseball and BBQ with Len and Jeff. Okay, guys, take it away.
Thank you, Mr. Friedman, Mr. Lou Friedman. We appreciate you coming on Baseball and BBQ for a second time. And if we get lucky, maybe 3, 4, 5 more times. Keep churning out those books. We love it.
We do love it. And as a matter of fact, during the interview, he mentioned another book that he had just received of his that he wrote. So
Hoyt Wilhelm.
Hopefully he will be back, because we'll have to read that book and have him back. But you know what's coming back, and that is barbecue season.
Yes.
And that means, I'm going to tell you what it means. It means you've got to get good equipment. If you're going to barbecue, you got to do it with good equipment. If you really want great tongs and spatulas and forks and cutting boards, head to baseballbbq.com. Not only are they great, but they look great. These tongs have baseball bat handles. You know, wonder like, how do I do that? Wait till you see it. You're going to love it. Go to baseballbbq.com. You'll be happy. But Jeff, what if they want to contact us? How do they do it?
Leonard, that's a great question.
Fabulous. I finally learned how to ask good questions.
There's several ways to do that. You can email us, baseballandbbq@gmail.com. You can leave a comment on our Facebook page, baseballandbbq. You can leave a comment on our X, @baseballandbbq. We have an Instagram, baseballandbarbecue, where barbecue is all spelled out. Leave us a voice message, 516-855-8214. And look at our website, www.baseballandbbq.weebly.com. And please rate, review, tell your friends. Give us a 5-star ratings on all those podcast apps. You know what to do.
Come on. We're doing the heavy lifting. We hope you enjoy the show. And if you do, it's a little perk if we could get those 5 stars.
Yeah.
That's okay.
And then before we move on to our quote of the week and our next guest, just want to talk to you about what happened recently. We're recording this on Wednesday the 13th. It's dropping on the 16th. So as we record this, we find out that Gerrit Cole is going to be out 1 to 2 months with an elbow injury.
this is nothing to celebrate. We know that there are fans who rejoice in injuries to other teams. Well, that's not what a sports person's approach. That shouldn't be. Gerrit Cole is a great pitcher and who has succumbed to an injury, I think to the elbow. And I would venture to guess 90 to 95% of pitchers will have an injury at some point. That's not a matter of if, it's a matter of when. But I know fans who rejoice at other teams' injuries. And we know this happens. Look, we're Mets fans. We're upset that Kodai Senga will miss time. If you're a Red Sox fan, you signed Lucas Giolito. And he was Mr. Reliable with the amount of innings year in and year out. And now he's out, most likely, for the season. Leonard, to be the best, you have to beat the best. And that was the Nature Boy Ric Flair. Even though I'm not a wrestling fan, those words are really true. And I just recently wrote an article by one of our former guests, Kevin Kernan, on the ball9.com website. It's called Spin Doctors. I would check that out because that was a really good article about the way ball players are throwing today and how they should be throwing or whatever. It's a good article. Check it out. And that's all I wanted to say.
I can't agree more with you, and you're right. But I have to say that with pitchers, basically when you have a pitcher and they say, oh, he's never been hurt, he eats all these innings, it's bound to happen. There is no way that a pitcher, the way they throw today, is not going to have some kind of arm issues, whether it's Tommy John, whether it's the shoulder, rotator cuff, whatever it is, it's going to happen. I agree totally with what you're saying. And as another thing, it used to be you'd say, oh, well, they have a five-man rotation, so that extra guy, I guess they'll have to stick him in the bullpen. But now, you better have three extra guys, four extra guys, five extra guys. Exactly. You better just have them at the ready, because you're not going through the season with five. That's impossible.
Exactly right. And you know, for those fans who celebrate other teams' injuries, come on.
No, but you know what, Jeff? I understand exactly what you're saying, but I'm going to tell you that as a fan of a team, yes, you want to face their best, you want to see their best, but it doesn't hurt sometimes. A fan shouldn't do it, but if a team comes in and their star player is injured and you're in a pennant race and it's going to help you win the game, you know, we're fans. So sometimes we don't think sensibly. So I get what you're saying.
Root for your team.
Yes, I understand. Root for the team, not for an injury.
Correct.
That is absolutely. And actually, that's my quote. But I've got a baseball. I got a barbecue one. So play the lead in and let me do the quote.
The barbecue quote of the week.
A great barbecue is a tribute to the backyard heroes who put in the hours to perfect their craft. That is said by Tuffy Stone, one of the best pitmasters around.
Oh, and you know another very good pitmaster around?
Yes, absolutely. And that is Richard Fergola, known as Fergie, for Fergalicious Barbecue. So let's hear what Fergie has to say. Baseball and barbecue fans, you're going to like this one, I can tell. You think we're going to have this gentleman on because of his barbecue prowess, and we're going to discuss barbecue. But then when you look at his website, it says he secretly wishes he was a Backstreet Boy. He's a Leo and former Chippendale dancer who loves Dairy Queen and has a mean front headlock. We'll get into all of that, find out what is true and what is not. But we are joined by Richard Fergola of Fergalicious Barbecue. He is a competition cook, teaches classes. I want to say taking the barbecue world by storm, but he's been around a while. It's more like we just are becoming acquainted with him, and we're glad we did. So, Richard, welcome to Baseball and Barbecue.
Welcome.
Thank you guys for having me. I appreciate it. Thank you very much.
So my first question is, how'd you come up with the name Fergalicious Barbecue?
So it's so funny you guys are asking me that question right now. I just moved into a new house and was meeting one of my neighbors today, and they asked me that very question just 30 minutes ago. So obviously with the last name Fergola, My nickname has been Fergie since I was at least 9 or 10 years old. My high school wrestling coach started calling me that when I was in junior high. And then Fergalicious came about. My youngest son, Rocco, he's 19 now, but when he was 6 years old, we were driving through town and there was an empty restaurant in town and he was sitting in the back seat and he just out of nowhere, he goes, "Hey, Daddy, you should buy that place and call it Fergalicious Barbecue." And I was kind of stunned by that. I kind of was like, first of all, how does my six-year-old know what Fergalicious is? Because the song had been out already by Fergie from the Black Eyed Peas. And I just couldn't believe that he came up with that. So like when he said it, I was like, a done deal, man. I mean, that's, except I spell it differently than she does. She spells it with an A and I spell it with an O because it's basically my last name. So, but that's how Fergalicious was born, man.
Nice.
But now he suggested at six that you open a restaurant. Did you follow his advice?
No, man, I've talked about it, but I've always just been like, that's just not for me. There's so much work involved. I mean, what I do now is so much work involved, but a restaurant's just a whole different animal. And I've got all the respect in the world for all of my barbecue friends that opened restaurants and you know, they'll tell me about it too. Like if we're sitting around having a couple beers, they'll be like, "Hey, do you want to," they'll just make jokes and be like, "Hey, do you want to buy a restaurant?" You know, cause they're like, they're just tired. You know what I mean? But a lot of my friends are very successful with that and they were made to do that and they do a great job with it. My friend Mike Johnson from Sugarfire or Blaine from Porky Butts or, you know, just I could go on and on about how many barbecue friends I have that have open restaurants, but that's just not for me.
A barbecue restaurant. You're from the Kansas area, right? Kansas City area.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the last thing they need is another barbecue restaurant there.
Right.
Yeah.
I know it's kind of like the rub and sauce world. It's so saturated, especially in this region. So to open a barbecue joint in Kansas City would just be, I mean, you better be doing something extremely different that's going to attract traffic because otherwise you're just going to probably close up shop really quick.
Yeah, we need you to go to an area like our area. I mean, we have some barbecue places, you know, we've got hometown. We got, Billy Durney.
Billy, yeah.
But when you could say an area and then say the one big barbecue restaurant in that area and everybody points to that and then it's like, okay, name another. And there's a couple, of course, but
sure.
It's not like when you say Kansas City and it's just like endless.
Right, right. Yeah, you can go on and on. I mean, that's probably the most asked question I get all the time, especially from my out of town friends is, you know, I get Facebook messages, text messages, emails like, "Hey, we're coming into town. Where should we go?" And to be honest with you, I unless they specifically ask me about going to a barbecue restaurant, I give them like 4 or 5 recommendations and it's none of them are barbecue restaurants.
Yeah.
Jeff, where did we go? Tell them about our trip.
We went to Slaps.
Yep.
And Arthur Bryant's.
Arthur Bryant's, yes.
Yeah.
Yep.
We had we had a great time standing in line. Was it Arthur Bryant's we stood in line with? We met some interesting people standing in line at Arthur Bryant's. That was a great experience, really. Yes.
And you went to the OG, right? The original one?
Yeah.
Yeah. And Joe has done a great job. I mean, basically you naming off those two, that's like old school and new school right there. So Joe Pierce has done an absolutely great job with his restaurant and I'm just happy to call him a friend. I mean, we met on the show Barbecue Pitmasters and we've been friends ever since. And just that where we were then and where we've come to now, it's a great story.
You mentioned about getting into the not getting into the restaurant business, but you also mentioned rubs and sauces. And you do have a rub line that you are in the business. You want to talk to us about that?
Yeah. So I came out with my first rub in I think 2015. It was actually probably about a year after my episode of Barbecue Pitmasters premiered and came out with it then. And then I've just been basically coming out with one almost about every year since. I have 6 that are sold worldwide right now. And I'm actually been going through a rebrand over the past year and that's getting ready to launch. We're hoping March 18th will be the launch of the new labels. My rubs are staying the same. All the seasonings are the same. I just changed the names of the rubs themselves and I rebranded the brand. So instead of being under Fergalicious, my brand is now Richard Fergola Barbecue Seasonings. My competition team will still be Fergalicious, but I'm super excited about it. I just got the new bottles in my hands so I could actually physically hold one. And I just put that out on my socials. And so I'm really excited for that to get launched.
Excellent. I don't see any sources on your website. Do you have any?
No, I'm trying to get through this rebrand first. And then, that's probably the next thing on the list as far as products go for me.
And I should probably mention the website is fergaliciousbbq.com. So go there and check it out.
Yeah, you can do now moving forward, you can do fergaliciousbbq.com or you can do richardfergolabbq.com. So they're one and the same now.
Gotcha.
So Richard, now we have to ask the obligatory question that we should have started with, but how you got started in barbecue and you were a teacher, right? And now you're in barbecue. Now you've got rubs. Now you're a winning competition cook. How does this all happen?
Well, yeah, I was a high school special education teacher for 21 years. I was a high school administrator for two of those years. I mean, I have two bachelors. I have two masters. I have a district level licensure in educational administration. I have half a doctorate in educational administration. And I was a high school and college wrestling coach for almost 18 years. Won a national championship as a college coach. And then I just got to the point where I got into barbecue because when I was leaving teaching and going into administration, I was leaving the district that I was at and my colleagues all got me a seat at a KCBS CBJ class to become a certified barbecue judge. And I was like, okay, I'll go do this. And I went and checked it out and I thought it was the coolest thing in the world. Then I went and judged about four or five comps just to kind of see what it was like. And I was immediately hooked. Went and walked around a couple contests locally in Kansas City and just thought, you know, looking at all the trailers and the smokers. And of course, I was a fan of barbecue pitmasters. I watched all the shows. I thought it was really cool. And I'm like, this is something I could do. And so when I got out of coaching, I got into the barbecue scene and started slowly dipping my toe. And then when barbecue pitmasters came calling, the toe dipping was over. We were diving in head first and going after it. And the world exploded after that. I have a very go-getter attitude. So if I'm going to do something, I want to be the best at it. And so, I mean, that's just how I attack everything. So barbecue is no different. So the rest was history after that.
You know, you mentioned being a teacher and actually you still are a teacher because you do give barbecue classes. So you're still a teacher.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm still, and I say that too. I'm still a teacher. It's nice. I just get to teach adults and, you know, you get to have fun while we're doing it, maybe have a beer or two. But I enjoy teaching barbecue classes very much. I've got my competition class coming up this weekend, actually, at Proud Souls, Kansas City. So I'm super excited for that. I actually got about a handful of people coming out from the East Coast, I think from the Boston area. Yeah, I enjoy teaching barbecue classes. I just enjoy teaching barbecue, period.
So you do have a competition pitmaster class, but you also have a backyard pitmaster class. I guess that's more, I would say, simplified for guys like me and Leonard. You know, tell us about what kind of people you get for them.
Yeah, so we do the backyard classes at the store. I've kind of transferred that over to Proud Souls, and we do those there. So we just cover everything, you know, brisket, ribs, chicken, pork, tri-tips, ribeyes, smoking pizzas, you know, anything that we can do to help our, not only our customer base, but people out there in the barbecue world that are just kind of entering this journey of grilling in their backyard or barbecuing and understanding how to run pits and fires and pellet grills and, you know, what kind of wood works the best, you know, all of those things that we all take for granted, like guys like me that do it all the time and teaching people how to, you know, master that craft in their backyard.
You know, Richard, what's amazing is you watch barbecue pitmasters and then you're like, I want to do that. I watch Van Halen in concert. I want to do that, but I can't. You become this, you know, you watch the show. The next thing you know, I'm sure it's not the next thing you know. So how does it go from watching the show to putting out rubs, teaching classes, winning competitions? What's the learning curve on that?
Yeah, that's an absolutely fantastic question. I get asked that in my comp classes a lot. You know, people want to know, how did you go, like what you just said, how did you go from being the guy sitting on your couch watching, being a fan of the show to making yourself be on it? And like I said just a few minutes ago, I was blessed with parents that basically told me growing up that I can accomplish anything if I put my mind to it. And I know that's a cliche-ish phrase and it's probably used a lot, but I believed in that. And that's just the way I was raised. That's the way I was molded. And so when I see something that I like and something that I want to do or feel like I can do, I go all in, man. I'm passionate, I'm determined, and I always have that competitor spirit in me. I always want to be the best at what I do. Whether I am the best at what I do remains to be seen. You know, I found the ways to make things happen and taught myself. And I'm going to figure this. I can ask this person this question. I can go see this. I learned a lot from watching Barbecue Pit Masters, just watching the show. And, you know, both of my parents were entrepreneurs. They own their own businesses. So I think ultimately after teaching for 21 years, that entrepreneurship gene came out in me. That my parents passed on to me and I found my niche in that arena. I actually like it better because, you know, I mean, I work for Proud Souls. I have bosses, I have superiors, but they are really, really good at just turning me loose and letting me do what I do, being good at it. So when you have that kind of support and that kind of backing, everything that is thrown your way, I can, you know, I just attack it fiercely and be like, I'm gonna be really good at this. So that's just kind of how I approach things.
Now, tell us about Proud Souls Barbecue and Provisions.
Yeah, I'll tell you what, this is probably the greatest group of barbecue and business guys I've ever come across. We've known each other for probably since 2017 when I was running the other store that I opened in Kansas City. Two of our owners, our main founder, Tony Roberts and Chris Webb, came down to Kansas City to take my competition class. And I took them out for dinner and drinks afterwards. Took out the whole class, actually. And they said, hey, man, we love what you do. And we want to steal you. We want to bring you over to Proud Souls. And we want to turn you loose and let you do what you do best, which is, you know, promotion, marketing, going out and cooking and doing those kind of things. And so that's the deal was done that night. I mean, that's the beauty of this. The owners are they cook barbecue contests. They have a passion for it just like I do. So we all support each other. And, you know, since I've come on board, we've opened two stores now. We've got the one here in Kansas City. We just opened up one in Orlando. And we've got our two stores in Colorado. And we just keep growing every single aspect of our business in every way we can.
That's fantastic. And you're also associated with Yonder Grills?
Yoder.
Yoder. Yoder Grills.
Yeah.
I should actually say. Yoder Grills. Yoder Grills. Yoder Smokers.
Yep. Yep. So so Proud Souls is one of the, if not the top dealer in the country when it comes to Yoders. And we are the first and only dealer in Kansas City with Yoders. They've never been sold in Kansas City, but they are a made in Kansas product. I was born and raised in Kansas. It was a no brainer for us to partner up. Joe Phillips, the owner of Yoder, is one of the greatest dudes I've ever met. Very supportive. And we're actually working on a project right now with my new trailer and rig. And it's so next year in competition, I'll be competing on Yoder. And I'm really excited about what the future brings in that aspect.
So you're going from Yoder to Yoder, but you were cooking on a Myron Mixon smoker, right?
Yeah, I've been competing on a Myron Mixon gravity feed pit for probably the last seven, eight mm-hmm. seasons. And it's also a fantastic pit. We sell them in our stores, especially our Colorado and Kansas City stores. But the partnership with Yoder, I just decided I wanted a new challenge. I wanted to do something different. So the new rig is going to have a custom-built Yoder offset stick burner and a Yoder pellet so I can do steak comps and all that kind of stuff. So I'll be fully equipped. And there's not really anything like that out there on the comp scene, at least not that I've seen, where you're just a full Yoder comp trailer out there doing KCBS comps. So I'm excited about that.
You know, you mentioned before we started recording, you moved into a new house. I'm just wondering how many barbecue cookers you have in your backyard.
I have, let's see, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. I think right now, I currently have 8.
More than you, Len.
that's all in the garage, but maybe 9. I think maybe I have 9. And I know I have uses for all of them. You know, I do a lot of video shoots and stuff here at the house. And yeah, when grilling is your is your game. You know, you gotta have one for every situation.
Yeah. I mean, I have four, but in New York, four is considered
10. It's considered 10.
Yeah, it's a decent number. So Richard, let's get to the hard hitting news. Okay, your website. What is this? You secretly wish you were a Backstreet Boy. Okay, we all do. I mean, come on. But you're a Leo. Okay, I could deal with that. That's good. A former Chippendale dancer. Okay, now where is fact and fit? Tell us about that.
Yeah. So let's put it this way. So I used to have a teammate, and he was also a teacher. He was who was on Barbecue Pitmasters with me, and he is really good at writing funny stuff like that. That's definitely one thing he did really well was. And so at that time, for all of our team members, he wrote funny bios like that.
Gotcha.
And I just never took it down because every time I read it, I just laugh. Obviously I was never a Chippendale dancer, but it was just a funny story. I'm not sure if I want to be a Backstreet Boy, but I could probably do that pretty well. And I can't remember. What's the rest say? I can't remember.
It's, well, you love Dairy Queen. I mean, that
is a 100% true statement. I can tell you this, when I leave a barbecue contest, if there's a Dairy Queen anywhere close by, I hit it. So
yeah.
I love Dairy Queen.
And you have a mean front headlock. Well, as a wrestling coach, I would imagine that might be the case.
Yeah. And he's also a former wrestling coach. So he kind of threw that one in there, but yeah, I always tease everybody that when I was still coaching, as I got older, I didn't want to move a lot. Like I didn't want to do a lot. So I just kind of would snap everybody into a front headlock and just choke them out. So then I could be done.
So Fergie, how many competitions do you do in a typical year?
In 2023, I did 40.
40, wow. That's...
I had a string of 3 or 4 years there where I was doing right around 30 every year. 2020, I only did one. That was the COVID year. I had a lot going on and I just took that year off basically. But I'm over 200 now. I think I'm at like 210 total. If that 2020 year wouldn't have happened, I'd be pushing 250 probably. But this year I'm probably gonna only do about 20. I think I have 21 on my calendar right now, just with the new rig and our new stores and my commitment to Proud Souls and just so many things going. I'm doing a competition class in Costa Rica. I'm doing a class in Chicago, and then I just have, I'm everywhere. So it's, I wanted to dial back the last year. I made a full commitment, mentally, that I was going to make a team of the year run to try to win team of the year. Obviously I didn't accomplish that goal, but this year I'm just going to kind of slow it down just a little bit.
It's hard to do competitions because I mean, you're busy all week and then it's every weekend. And you got to prep for it, right? So it's really tough to it's all your weekends. Does your wife do the competitions with you? Does she travel with you?
She did. Unfortunately, we're no longer together anymore, but
oh,
it's all good. But she did travel with me, but I'm more of a solo act anyways. Sometimes my mom would go with me. I like to get her out of the house. Sometimes, she likes to travel with me. And then I have a really good friend of mine. We've been friends for over 30 years, whenever he has the opportunity, he can go with me too. But, if I'm being frank and everybody I just mentioned, they all know this. I mean, I like cooking by myself because I can flow better and I know exactly what's going on. I don't have any distractions. And I talk about that a lot in my comp classes about, competition barbecue psychology, the psychology of the game and just, you know, how you run your profiles and how you run your ship and just all that stuff. And when you're by yourself, it's you're a little bit more laser focused on your goals. And so I enjoy that. It gets a little lonely, especially when you're driving, you know, 15, 16, sometimes 20 hours. But yeah, it is hard. Not everybody's made for that life. It's a lot of time from away from home and family and you know, if you drive all that way and then you don't have the results you want, it's even harder. So it's always good when you go that far and you come home with a GC, at least you got hardware and, you know, some gas money in your pocket. So, but I still enjoy it. I love the challenge of it. I wouldn't change it for anything.
Now tell us about, you appeared on Pitmasters as well as Chopped. So how does one get on Pitmasters and what was the experience like?
Well, unfortunately, Pitmasters isn't around anymore. But the way we got on was they had casting for it, and they asked for an audition video. And so we shot our audition video at my home, just on our phone. And, you know, that was back in 2014. So phones weren't even that, video wasn't even that great then. But we shot it there, and I edited it myself and put it all together. And lo and behold, New Year's Eve, I got a phone call that day, and they said, hey, we want you to come on Barbecue Pitmasters. And come to find out, the other two teams, Slaps and Sugar Fire, when we got down to Tampa and we were filming, they were showing me their audition videos that they spent thousands of dollars on. So I still tease them about that. I'm like, hey, man, we shot our video on my phone. But it was great. Chopped is a similar thing. They send out casting calls. You fill out an application, send in an audition video. And I was fortunate enough to get selected for that. We actually filmed that up in your guys' neck of the woods. We filmed that in Queens, actually. So I got to spend about a week in New York filming that. And then when I got chopped, I just went downtown and started drinking beer.
You filmed that where, in Kaufman Studios? Where in Queens?
No, it was Chop Grill Masters. So we were outside. So we filmed it a petting zoo in Queens.
Okay.
Yeah, the meat was very fresh.
Yeah, it was a petting zoo, and our hotel was in Queens. And they just picked us up in a minivan and took us over to the petting zoo. And I mean, there were people like walking around, like customers at the petting zoo, but they had our section of the set, you know, kind of blocked off. And that was, that's a major production there when you're doing Food Network Chopped. I mean, that's, you know, 100 plus people on set, and just, it was major.
Yeah. Let me ask you about when you do competitions, how do you secure your food? I see you have an affiliation with Prairie Fresh. Are you still affiliated with them? And that's what you get your pork and other food?
Yes, I am. I am sponsored by Prairie Fresh. And so I get all my pork and my ribs from them. And basically we just get them through our store, Proud Souls. And then I pick out what I need and just we relay that back to them. My chicken I purchase here in Kansas City, and then I cook all Snake River Farms gold briskets. We have a great relationship with them. I think it's the best brisket in the world, and we carry them in our store as well. And so that's how I do it. So when we get our meat, I try to trim about 6 to 8 contests at once. So I like to get all my brisket flats and my ribs and pork all trimmed up and cryovacked and in the freezer, ready to roll. So that way when comp week comes up, all I got to do is just pull them out and I'm ready to rock.
You know, Proud Soul sounds like such a great place. You know, we have plenty of room on Long Island if you want to open up another store here.
Hey, you're not the first one from the East Coast that tries to get us come out there. Billy Gillespie from Smoking Hogs there in the Boston area, he's always on me about, hey, you know, we could really use a Proud Souls out here. And you're right. We're in Florida, but yeah, that Northeast area would be a good spot.
Yeah.
Yeah. Barbecue is huge, and it's here. It's big here. It's big everywhere. Give us now. I don't know the percentage of listeners that are competition cooks or backyard cooks, but Jeff and I are backyard cooks. So what's one of the big pointers that you could give a backyard cook that would help elevate the cooking to another level?
I think one of the biggest things that I always tell people is that they must understand that barbecue, whether you're cooking in your backyard or at a world championship, is all about tenderness. And when I say that, I always follow it up with what I mean by that is that you have to understand how to cook it correctly, which means understanding the appropriate time it takes to get to the tenderness that you need to achieve to make it a great product. You know, a lot of people, I think that's one of the most asked questions I get in the store is people will come in and be like, you know, Ferg, I did my first brisket the other day and I thought it was a little tight. It wasn't, it was dry or whatever. And then when I always ask them 9 times out of 10, I ask them, well, what temperature did you pull it at? And 9 times out of 10, they're like, oh, I pulled it at like, you know, 190 or something like that. So there's this misconception about what's the done temperature of whatever you're cooking. In briskets, I use that example because I get asked that one most. But You know, and I always have to tell them, well, A, you got to cook it longer, man. You're about, you know, 15 degrees off. And B, I also ask them, what kind of a thermometer temperature gauge are you using? And again, 9 times out of 10, they're not using a ThermoPen like from ThermoWorks, which is what everybody in the barbecue world uses. It's what I use. It's what I trust. And so I have to gear them that way because, you know, a lot of times they're buying something that's like $5 or $10 at a, you know, at a big box store, like a hardware or whatever. And those things are just not accurate. You have to understand A, what that ending temperature is, and also what that feels like. You need to understand what 205 in a brisket flat feels like. If you don't know what that feels like, then you don't know what a done brisket feels like. And I get that a lot in my comp classes where people say, well, we were at this comp and we thought we turned in really good food. And then, but the judges didn't like it, they'll say. And then my response to them is, how many contests have you cooked? And they usually come back and be like, well, I think we've done 5 total. And I'm like, my answer back to them is, you don't know what done is yet. You don't know what good is yet. And I always have to follow it up because that sounds bad when I say that. It's like, that's not a negative comment to you guys. It's just that you don't have the time in the game yet to understand what that means. I didn't know that for a long time. It took me a long time to figure that out. And it just came from cooking and cooking and cooking and cooking. And it's the same thing in the backyard. You know, if you don't know what that number is or what that feels like, then every time you do it, it's going to be, you know, it's not going to be where it could be or what it should be because you haven't figured that out yet. And so that's why I think educating in classes is a really good thing because we can shorten that learning curve for people in the backyard and in competition and be like, okay, you're cooking a brisket. If you're cooking this one, you need to take this to like 207, 208. That's where you need to be. This is what it feels like. That's why when I have classes and it's done, I take my ThermoPen. I call up people and let them probe it themselves so they can feel what that's a nice thing about ThermoPen is not only does it tell you the temperature, it lets you feel what that actually feels like. You know, people always ask me, what's your favorite thermometer? And I say, besides the ThermoWorks, it's these right here, my hands. You know, when I can feel my ribs, when I can feel the money muscle, when I can feel chicken and I can feel that, I know I'm either in the game or I'm not. Long-winded answer. Sorry.
No worries.
That's okay. So how long was it that you were cooking, winning competitions, whatever, before you started teaching a class?
Not very long. I started Fergalicious in 2012, and I think the very first class I taught was in 2015. And I'll openly admit, maybe that was premature. You know, I had accomplished some decent things by that point. But I think the reason why I say I'm a little different in that area was just because I was a teacher, and I still was a teacher at that time. So I just naturally gravitated to that. You know, I'm like, we could do some cool backyard stuff and teach everything that we know that we've learned or whatever and have fun with it. And I just enjoyed teaching. So I think that's why I probably pushed myself into that arena faster than I probably should have. And what I mean by that is, you know, I'm a huge believer in having some credentials, things that you've accomplished that I want people to feel good about that who they're coming to learn from is as actually accomplished and the things that are coming out of my mouth are, you know, legit things. So, it's like anything else, you know, I mean, I'm not gonna, you know, if I'm going to learn how to be a race car driver, I'm going to find the best NASCAR driver I can to teach me how to do it. You know what I mean? It's like, you want the best in the game that's been there and done that. But yeah, 2015.
Okay. So, I mean, you were doing it for 3 years and you had the experience that works for me.
I'm a far better barbecue teacher now than obviously.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And it's, I mean, I've taught almost 100 classes now. So it, you know, obviously you get better with time.
Absolutely. You're also a representative for Royal Oak Barbecue Briquettes. And on that page, it says you're the founding member of the National BBQ League. Did you tell us about that? And are you still involved?
Royal Oak Charcoal. Yes, I've been with Royal Oak Charcoal for, oh man, a long time now. And that's actually an interesting story. When people ask about how I get sponsors and things like that, you know, when I first reached out to Royal Oak long time ago, I couldn't even get responses from them. And And then when I finally did, after a couple of years, they were really upfront with me and just said, you know, I wasn't a good enough cook yet. From a statistical standpoint, you know, my credentials weren't there yet. And I said, okay. And so the next year went by and I did really well. And I emailed them and I said, here's what I accomplished. And they asked me what my address was. And charcoal started showing up. Fast forward to now, I was one of their very first true ambassadors. We have, I think there's probably a dozen of us now, myself, Megan Day, Mike Johnson, Heath Riles, Malcolm Reed. I can go on and on. As far as a founding member of the National Barbecue League, I wasn't a founding member. I was one of the original members. The founding members were Tim Scheer and Brad Leininger. They founded the National Barbecue League, but the very first year they created it, they had 10 of us on that roster, and I was one of those original members. I'm still a part of the Barbecue League. They're getting ready to drop my full competition brisket video, I think, next month. And I've been with them ever since they started it. So, and that's been an absolutely great thing for barbecue. And we still do think Proud Souls has partnered up with the Barbecue League. We just had an event at our Florida store last Thursday. So there'll be a lot more events coming up with us in the Barbecue League.
Excellent.
Now, Richard, you know, it's funny you mentioned that it took a couple of years and then you had bags of charcoal showing up. You appear on Pitmasters and Chopped, and you've made a name for yourself in barbecue. I wonder what comes across your driveway or your doorstep on a daily basis, because I'm sure now it's the other way. It's like, oh, could you represent us? Could you, you know, market this for us? You probably get hit up a lot for that.
I do get hit up a lot. I'm very loyal to Royal Oak as far as charcoal goes. I don't use anything else. I never have. As far as Prairie Fresh goes, it's an absolutely fantastic pork company. They're based right here out of Kansas City, Kansas. And the people that I work with there are they're fully supportive. They take care of all my needs and they produce the best pork in the world. Snake River Farms, they take really good care of me there. Manella, who everybody works with there at Snake River, she's absolutely awesome with that brand, and I'm proud to represent that as well. And I do get offers on a lot of things, but it's you know, it used to be a little different how that would work out. But you're right, it's and it has to be the right situation for me. You know, this is my job. When the right ones come by, we have conversations. If they're not right, then we just move on. So,
and what about, you know, you have the experience with the TV shows. So there are a couple of shows that, you know, there's Barbecue Brawl and Barbecue Showdown. You've got, right, one of them is on Netflix. I'm sure they're always looking for people. Have they reached out to you? Is that something we're going to see?
Barbecue Throwdown, the Netflix one, they actually reached out to me the first season. And when they called me, they called me and they were like, so... And they knew who they were calling and they said, hey, we're looking for somebody that, you know, likes to cook in their backyard, has maybe done some competitions, maybe has their own products and, you know, does this and that. And they go, do you know anybody like that? And I go, yeah, me. And they said, well, you're Fergalicious Barbecue, right? And I go, yeah. And they go, they told me that I was too experienced for that first season. And I have applied for it again. I haven't heard anything back. And Barbecue Brawl, same thing. That first season, I was interviewing with them and then COVID hit and then I've never heard back from them again. So I apply every year for that one, but that's just how that game works. You know, if you're right for it and you hit the right time, you know, right place at the right time for that show, that's usually how it goes. They kind of come in spurts. You know, I mean, I've been on a show almost, you know, every few years since 2014. So Barbecue Country, that came across last year and I was on that show, made the finale of that. That was a lot of fun. You know, another one will come by and, you know, we'll rock it again.
Yeah, we're hoping to see you more and more on TV, on the show, on TV. Before we let you go, I have one last question before I ask you to promote your socials. The Kansas City Chiefs won 2 Super Bowls in a row. Will they win 3?
Hey, right here, baby. You see that? You see that on my hand there?
A tattoo on your hand, yes.
That says Chiefs on it.
There you go. Yes.
Kansas City Chiefs, yes.
It doesn't say Royals. It doesn't say Kansas City Royals. It says Chiefs.
No. I got that tattoo last year after we won the Super Bowl. I actually have a tattoo appointment this Sunday. I'm getting some more stuff done this Sunday. But I'll tell you what, dude, it's a great time to be a Chiefs fan. It's an absolutely great team, great staff. It's exciting around here. And I'm looking, if we keep most of this team intact, I don't see how we can't have a shot at winning it next year, too. So all the haters out there that are, you know, I was just before I got on here with you guys, I was looking at something on social media, and it was a QB ranking for the year. And they had Patrick Mahomes ranked number 3 behind Lamar Jackson and Josh Allen. And I'm like, wait a minute. We beat both those dudes in the playoffs on the road and then won another Super Bowl back to back, his third one. And I'm like, but we're the third best quarterback. So whatever.
Right. And he's still a young kid. He's not even 30 yet. So.
He's not even that. He's like in his late 20s. I'm like, the guy is an animal, man. He's a beast, and we have a great program.
Yeah. And they're gonna be pretty good for the next couple of years, that's for sure.
Oh yeah. So, that's for sure. Yeah.
So why don't you promote your socials? You're on Twitter or X or Facebook, whatever. Tell us where people can find you.
Yeah, Fergalicious. I'm on Instagram, X, and Facebook, and also TikTok. And then Richard Fergola Barbecue is also on Instagram, Facebook. And then we got Proud Souls. We're all on Instagram, Facebook, TikTok. But most notably, we are on YouTube, Proud Souls. I mean, so if you want to see myself on that, and that's Fergalicious is all Fergalicious BBQ, Richard Fergola BBQ. And then our YouTube channel for Proud Souls is Proud Souls BBQ. And we're really trying to grow that. As a matter of fact, next week, we're spending an entire 7 days in a row filming in Kansas City. And then in April, we're filming for an entire week in Colorado. And then in July, we're filming for an entire week in Florida. So there's going to be all kinds of awesome, cool, different content coming out on our Proud Souls YouTube channel.
Florida in July. The best move. Oh,
you're going to see us cooking on the beach. It's going to be all kinds of cool stuff.
Richard, thank you for joining us on Baseball and Barbecue. We really appreciate it. And, you know, we're Met fans, but I know the Royals are in Kansas City. We went to Kansas City last year, Lynn and I, and had a great time. And yeah. And Pat Mahomes' father pitched for the Mets, so a little connection there. So
that's awesome. And I think our last World Series, who did we beat in the World Series?
Oh, nice speaking to you, Richard. I, you know.
Goodbye. Goodbye. What? Jeff, what? You know, you need to vet our guests better.
I know.
Oh, my.
Richard, thank you for joining us on Baseball and BBQ.
All right. Thank you, guys. I appreciate it. Had a blast.
Thank you, Richard. Thank you very much, Richard Fergola of Fergalicious Barbecue. Jeff, let's start thanking people, because Lou Friedman, who we started the show with, we thank him. We thank him for writing a great book. We thank Richard Fergola of Fergalicious Barbecue. I thank you.
I thank you.
I say you're welcome.
I thank our listeners.
Our listeners are the best, and we thank them. And we are presented by Bet Online. You know, it's where the game starts. But I think we can all agree we've done a lot of show. It's time that we didn't start, but we ended. And Jeff, how do we end?
With the poet.
That is none other than Shel Krakowski.
And the musician.
The great Dave Dresser.
And the song.
Baseball always brings you home.
And we'll see you next week on episode number 231.
Bring the applause. Peace.